Good evening, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website, which is www.theorganicview.com. If you have any questions or would like to connect with us, you can simply post a question on our wall on Facebook, send a tweet to @TheOrganicView, or contact me directly at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com.
Today's show is sponsored by Austria's Finest Naturally Authentic Pumpkin Seeds and Pumpkin Seed Oil from the Steiermark, available at organicuniverse.com. Listeners of The Organic View can receive $1 off their purchase by using the coupon code ORGVIEW. That's ORGVIEW.
For other promotional offers, please visit TheOrganicView.com's website.
On today's show, the Honorable Mary Nash Stoddard will be joining me to talk about artificial sweeteners and why they are being added to so many foods, cough and cold medicine, as well as other products that most consumers are not aware of. So I'd like to welcome to the show Mary Nash Stoddard. Hello, Mary.
Hi there, June. Thanks for having me.
It is always a pleasure to speak to my sweetest friend in America. And
oh,
to pick your brain. I remember it wasn't too long ago when Hurricane Sandy hit, and I had the same cold that everybody else had in this area, and I reached for one of my favorite over-the-counter cough medicines, and lo and behold, it had an artificial sweetener in it, to which my overly sensitive system did not appreciate. So it's been quite a learning curve for myself. I mean, people tend to think about artificial sweeteners just being in low-calorie beverages or, I hate to put it like this, but diet food. And
that's right.
That's basically how society has conditioned us to think of these products as something that is part of diet food or for people that need to lose weight. So they basically need these chemicals to trick the body into thinking that it's sweet. And
right.
The reality is that these chemicals, for the most part, have become ubiquitous. And folks, that is basically what we're going to be talking about tonight. And before we actually get into the discussion, Mary, could you just take a moment and share a little bit about yourself with our listeners?
Thanks, June. Well, I'm, for the past three decades, the founder and spokesperson of the International Aspartame Awareness Campaign. I, in 1992, qualified in court as an expert medical witness. I served a full term as a judge on a state court in Dallas, Texas. I'm the PR person who helped get FDA approval of stevia. I promote researchers who publish books and scientific studies on aspartame and sweeteners. And I'm the author of a toxicology source book on aspartame. So I founded a pilot's hotline when asked to do that. And I've produced 60 Minutes news exposés in the U.S. and Australia and other countries around the world, documentaries in France, and, you know, truly international effort, and it's all volunteer.
Thank you. Mary, can you share with our listeners, when exactly did aspartame hit the market?
Well, it was approved in 1981, and it didn't actually get on the market, on the shelves in powder form as Equal until 1982, and it still wasn't approved yet for aqueous solution, diet drinks and sodas and things, until 1983. So in the spring of 84, it came on the market full-time in diet drinks, diet sodas.
Now, in addition to aspartame, can you talk a little bit about saccharin? When did that hit the market? I remember very vividly seeing those pink packets and my very first experience with it, and all I thought to myself was, this stuff is disgusting. Why would anybody It had that nasty, vile aftertaste. And all I thought to myself was, my God, you know, who would want this? But a lot of people did.
They did. In fact, my grandmother used to put a tiny little tablet of saccharin in her coffee in the mornings. And this was, in the 40s and 50s. So,
and it was kind of trendy, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very trendy and pretty much the only artificial sweetener out there. Later on, it was branded as Sweet and Low and produced by the Cumberland Corporation in New York, I believe. And in fact, one of my acquaintances was Mary Kay Ash of Mary Kay Cosmetics. And I was in her office one day and she said, "Oh, I know sweeteners." She said, "I wouldn't touch aspartame, but look." And she tossed a pink packet of Sweet and Low. She said, "Here's what I use." And I said, "Oh, well, that's nice, Mary Kay." And she said, "Turn it over." I did, and it had her face on the back of it. She said, "My friend Norman Eisenstadt, I believe, president or CEO of the company, makes these just for me." So Sweet and Low has been around a long time and is very popular. There really haven't been more than 6 complaints turned in to the FDA about Sweet and Low in the mid-90s, I believe. That was their statistic, and thousands had been turned in on aspartame. But Sweet and Low, or saccharin, was the one the FDA chose to get off the market so that aspartame could be put on, even with a scarcity of adverse reaction complaints to turn to and say, "Look, here, saccharin is a horrible product." So anyway, we were drinking cyclamates in diet drinks in the 70s. I used to do the ads for Diet Dr. Pepper when it had cyclamates in it. And we drank a lot of it. And I wouldn't do that now, and I'm not really proud of it, but I'm saying everybody was doing it back there at that time. So it was an easy transition for me in 1984 when they first, it was the end of 84 when I had my first diet drink with aspartame in it in the hospital when my husband was dying of brain cancer, ironically. And I didn't like the taste and thought, well, if I have to drink it, you know, I'd rather do that than sugar. And so I went to the diet sweetener myself and started getting really sick from it.
Now, I have a question for you in regards to saccharin. I just want to digress for a minute. Wasn't that a product that was owned by Monsanto at one point?
Yes. There is a history of Monsanto owning it. I'm not real familiar with Monsanto and saccharin, but I do know the Cumberland Corporation produced it when I got into the aspartame awareness campaign and started our organization, Aspartame Consumer Safety Network. So Monsanto has its hand in a whole lot of different things, and saccharin.
Well, they're a very successful company. I mean, yeah, they are a huge, very successful company, and they do own quite a bit. But
yes, they owned aspartame at one time, the NutraSweet company. They owned it. Monsanto did.
Then what happened? How did that, I guess, who bought it then?
Well, Monsanto split the company, and the food division went to the NutraSweet company in Chicago, in Deerfield, Illinois, and the manufacturing for agricultural products, as I understand it, if memory serves me right, it went to a different division. And so the NutraSweet company took over after that. Then it was subsequently sold to Marisant, and the J.W. Childs Foundation. It was owned at one time by Dell Computers out of Austin, and it's had a checkered past. In fact, it's been passed off so many times so that the original people, G.D. Searle was the founder of the pharmaceutical company. They made their initial money, and then they got out before the lawsuits started to come. I guess they were smart.
Now, Mary, what are some of the other names that aspartame goes by?
It goes by Neotame, which is 13,000 times sweeter than aspartame. And at the Senate hearings, when I gave testimony for aspartame safety, well, that was the name of the hearing, I gave against aspartame safety and my experience with the FDA. But we were calling Neotame at that time aspartame 2000. And it was approved by the FDA over all of our objections, all of the brilliant scientists' objections, and a lot of other people who you wouldn't expect to protest it, and it went through anyway. So it's also called Advantame, it's called Amino Sweet, and it's called Twin Sweet, Canderel in the UK and other countries. But Twin Sweet and NutraSweet and Equal are all manufactured by the NutraSweet company in Deerfield, Illinois. So those are a few of the names. I think other countries it's sold under various different names. And
why do they sell it under so many different names?
Oh, I don't know. I think because, well, the NutraSweet company lost the patent on it in 1992, so that anybody around the world could make it. It's not that difficult to produce and manufacture. So, ironically, I think aspartame originally costs $90 per pound to sell. But anyway, people all over the world are making it, and they're calling it their own brand name.
You could actually have the Mary Nash Stoddard version of aspartame, and you could call it Mary-tame.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Wow. You've got to love the entrepreneurial opportunities right there.
Yeah, I sort of facetiously say sometimes anybody can make it in their garage, you know, like methamphetamines, I guess, and other dangerous things.
And it's perfectly legal.
Yeah, it's very legal. And it's up to the FDA to recall this and retest it as a drug. They could do it, but they won't. And so that's where we are now. We have to be our own FDA, I guess. They're not protecting us.
Mary, what are some of the legal requirements pertaining to labeling as far as foods and other products? Because I've noticed that pretty much everything from dental floss to mouthwash, cold products, cough and cold products, mm-hmm. all sorts of products that really don't need to be sweetened are. And
right.
my biggest pet peeve, I think, is with the dental floss, because it's so difficult to find unflavored dental floss. And for those of you mm-hmm. that believe in good oral hygiene, dental floss, flossing is equally as important as brushing. And the thing is that everything that's on the market is mint flavored. They don't have any, it's very hard. And I'm in New York. It's very hard for me to find unflavored dental floss, and it's just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And to me, every single time that I'm exposed to these chemicals, it adds up, and my system is very sensitive. So for me, I avoid it like the plague.
Yes, the effects are cumulative, which is important to know. I'm glad you brought that up, because the aspartame itself breaks down into byproducts and goes into methanol, 10% methanol, formaldehyde, 50% phenylalanine, 40% aspartic acid, and other breakdown products, DKP, which is a brain tumor agent. But those things don't stay around in your body, with the exception of formaldehyde. That does. It binds with different cells and things in the body and stays around. But the effects accumulate. It's like when your brain is attacked by the phenylalanine and the methanol and aspartame, it damages a certain portion of the brain or a certain place on an organ, a kidney or a lung or whatever. And that effect accumulates and gets bigger and bigger on added exposure. So the levels of aspartame can't be measured. That's one of the problems. If it could be, we could be tested and we could get it off the market quickly, because we could show harm easier if there was a test for it. But anyway, it is in so many products. It's even in the numbing solution that the dentist puts on your gums prior to the injection of the Novocaine or anesthesia in dental work. So now they have to find another kind of numbing solution to put on my gums when I come in, because I won't have anything with aspartame in it. So you have to ask. I mean, be a really curious person and don't mind what people might think. Have it put in your medical records that you react to aspartame, and so you do not want anything prescribed for you or your family that contains phenylalanine. And here we go back to the label. There was a labeling act that came out of those Senate hearings I attended that was the only thing that the Senate could do. They couldn't recall the drug, but they could require labels by federal law. And so that's because of the phenylketonuric aspect, the PKU individuals. When babies are born and have a heel stick test, 1 in 10,000 are test positive for PKU. And if they get aspartame, if they get too much phenylalanine in their diet, that causes mental retardation. And this is a severe situation. So that required the label. But they have chosen, when Neotame was approved in 2002, the FDA chose to dispense with the labeling for PKUs, the warning, because they said you wouldn't use as much. And in tests, they have been shown by the manufacturer that it doesn't raise the levels of phenylalanine. And by the way, in the original test that G.D. Searle submitted when Donald Rumsfeld was CEO of the company and submitted it to the Food and Drug Administration for approval in 81, they falsified the tests. And in a later lawsuit against that same company with the same set of scientists, a woman won a $9 million lawsuit against G.D. Searle because they falsified the test for a different product, but it was the same scientists and the same company, and the same practices were uniform in that company. They lied and they cheated to get their products on the market. And if that hadn't happened, we wouldn't even be sitting here talking about aspartame as a sweetener. But it did, and we have to deal with it now because the FDA is not going to change it.
No, it certainly is not. And I'd like to I'd like to take a call. This our next, actually our The person that's on the line is Betty McDeese, who's the executive director of Birth Defect Research for Children. And she's got quite a lot to say as far as this very topic is concerned. So, Betty, are you on the air with us? Are you there?
I am. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening, and welcome to the show, Betty. Betty, could you just share with our listeners a little bit about yourself and the organization?
Sure. Our organization provides information, parent support, and resources to families, but our main project is that we sponsor the National Birth Defect Registry, which collects information on all kinds of exposures, genetic and health history of both the mothers and the fathers, and we analyze the data and look for clusters or patterns of birth defects. And we've been successful in finding patterns that have been later confirmed by other types of studies. So that's primarily what we do. And, of course, since aspartame and other artificial sweeteners are chemicals that we're not sure about their effects during pregnancy, they are on our questionnaire for our registry. I think, with everything that we're looking at as far as environmental birth defects, it's a combination of genetic predisposition that's triggered by something. It might be a virus, it might be aspartame, it might be some other chemical or radiation. So you're looking at a 1-2 punch kind of thing. And with the aspartame, our concern is that if a unborn child carries even the gene for PKU and the mother is consuming a lot of products with aspartame in them, that they can have an adverse impact on the unborn child, even though that child may not be born with PKU, it just is carrying the gene for PKU.
Yes, yes. And by the way, phenylalanine, as you know, Betty, quadruples on the side of the placenta, which makes it even more an endangerment for the fetus.
Well, that's correct. And the thing that is so disheartening is that no one really understands today how much they may be exposed to this chemical. It can be in so many products, and now that it's in baked goods, it's almost impossible to know. So a pregnant woman has to be very vigilant in trying to limit her exposure, not just to drinks that are, low-cal, but all kinds of products.
Yes, and as you also probably know, registered dietitians in the past have been telling pregnant women aspartame is not a problem for them. It's safe and natural like bananas and milk. And we know that isn't true, and the sooner we stop saying that to pregnant women, the better off we'll be as far as birth defects go. And thank you for what you do.
Well, thank you for your thank you. That's true of everything. There is no substance that is totally safe for every pregnancy and every pregnant woman. And so, you can't be a nihilist when it comes to medications or substances, but you can try to control your environment as much as possible. It's very heartening to me. We have a section on our website called the Healthy Baby Resource, which covers all aspects of pregnancy, from exercise to occupational exposure, even military exposure, community exposures. And I used to worry, well, we'll just never get anybody coming to that section, because they'll only come if they have a child with a problem. That section of our website is now getting more traffic than any other part. And the most interesting thing is we get slightly more men than women.
Wow.
The demographics are so fascinating. So,
For those men.
Good for those men. Well, one of the battles that we have fought for many years is on the side of male-mediated birth defects. In other words, the idea that just what a woman is doing has a total impact on the pregnancy. We know that what the man does can have an impact as well. And so,
absolutely,
we are. I think we're the only registry in the country that collects data on the father's exposures, and
that's
we also
excellent.
Are the only registry that collects on both structural and functional birth defects. And by functional, we mean things like attention disorder, autism, learning disabilities, neurodevelopmental problems, all of those things that we used to think we didn't know why they happened, but now more and more research is showing they have a prenatal origin.
Well, now most everybody has one of those, one of the things that you just described, one of, I don't know how you classify it, I'm not a medical doctor, but so many people have ADD or ADHD,
yeah.
so many different things. And it used to be something that wasn't common. And so the response was, well, it wasn't diagnosed. Well, now almost everybody has one thing or the other. So that's something to really think about.
That's true. You know, and it's interesting when you said that a common exposure that people just, you know, will continue to say it's okay. There are two big studies, one I believe that came out of the Netherlands, and I forget what the other one, on acetaminophen or Tylenol that are connecting that to ADHD. And these are big studies. I mean, these are very big studies. We have a great concern about just blanket approval to pregnant women that, oh, that's just fine to take. That's a very powerful medication, even though it's over-the-counter. And it's the same with aspartame.
Yes.
Just because it's in a lot of things doesn't mean it's okay.
Or by the way.
Especially doesn't mean it's okay for everybody.
Right. Tylenol also contains aspartame. Tylenol. Many of the, they do produce probably two different kinds. They produce one that has it and one that doesn't. But you can pretty much be sure if it's an oral suspension medication for children, infants and children, it has aspartame in some form or other. So look for phenylalanine on the label. Contains phenylalanine is the code word for aspartame.
Thank you, Mary.
That's always
now,
good.
Really quickly, we're almost out of time, but I guess, Betty, could you just quickly share with our listeners Karen's story?
Well, Karen contacted us some years ago about her son, Brandon. She had not only drunk a lot of aspartame-sweetened drinks during pregnancy, but she had also taken, capsules from the health food store. And her son was born with severe neurological problems that involved having to have a trach tube and severe retardation, and, you know, he's just never going to be okay. So research was done at Emory. Dr. Elsius did research where he gave her capsules of the aspartame. I'm going to say that because I can pronounce it correctly.
Yeah.
And then he did blood tests of the concentration of that in her system, and it showed that her blood plasma concentrations rose 2 to 2.5-fold over the 12 days without an increase in other amino acids that would neutralize that. So there was an imbalance. And like you said, Mary, the placenta could have magnified this even more, creating even a larger imbalance. And so his hypothesis that Brandon's developing brain cells could have been chronically exposed to as much as 500 to 600 milligrams of aspartame. So
yes, and by the way, his picture is in our book, Deadly Deception, Story of Aspartame. I worked with Karen, his mother, and published an article in the Association of Birth Defect newsletter at one time. And that story is just very touching and frightening. And it could happen to anybody.
I hate to say this, but we are out of time. Folks, the article itself will be on the companion article to this interview. I'm terribly sorry, but we're going to have to pick this up next week. But Betty, thank you so much for joining us. And Mary, it's always been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night. And folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a great evening.